Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. I've done well over 100 shows now. However, for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea is I speak to a designer, maker, artist or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Today, my guest is Jonathan Smales, a housing developer, well, like no other as far as I'm aware. He's the co-founder and executive chairman of Human Nature, whose new project, The Phoenix, on the outskirts of Lewes, East Sussex in the UK, has just won planning. What makes the development different? Well, The Phoenix will contain 685 homes designed by a roster of fascinating architects, who'll be working materials such as structural timber and hemp. The development would be pretty much vehicle-free, with residents encouraged to make use of a car share scheme, an electric bike service or a shuttle bus. It'll have amenities including a community canteen, event hall, tap room, fitness centre and maker studios. There'll be shared courtyards, parks and green corridors to promote communal living and provide habitats for local wildlife. As the architecture critic Rowan Moore wrote in The Observer recently, it looks, in a land where new homes are largely lumpen products of volume house builders, miraculous. Jonathan also has one of those CVs that makes you wonder what you've been doing with your time. Over the years, he's been managing director of Greenpeace, an advisor on sustainability issues to the government, and he also led the Earth Centre project, regenerating a former coal mine outside Doncaster. Jonathan, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm feeling really intimidated after the introduction, Grant. So I was fine, and now let's see. But it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
No, it's a joy to have you. I mean, was it reasonably accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Good. We have a tradition, Jonathan, on this show of asking guests to give our listeners a bit of context. I mean, we're talking over Zoom, so I can see your backdrop, which is very pleasantly verdant with pot plants. Maybe you can describe your office and where it is, what it looks like.
Yeah, we're in a 70s neo-brutalist modernist oblong, probably hated when it was first built and now actually rather tolerated happily by the good people of Lewes. I'm in Lewes, which is actually my hometown, as well as the site for the Phoenix that you referred to with your very generous remarks in the introduction. And it's our HQ. It's wonderful. It's glazed all the way around. Mm. Hopelessly hot in summer, hopelessly cold in winter. We're deconstructing the building, taking out all the artificial ceilings and revealing its structure. So it looks a bit like an early Norman Foster when you're in here.
Okay.
And as I said, it's glazed pretty much all the way around. So we get to see our site. So when we're having like a master planning meeting or a you point out of the window or we'll rush out on site, form a human chain, start measuring the width of a street in a very human way. It's a fantastic way to design, actually. You can just check a condition with your designers live in the middle of a creative workshop. So that's where we are. Yeah, that's where we are.
How many people are you?
25. But I always say that with the quality of architects and number and range of architects that we have and engineers and cost consultants and so on, it feels like we've got a team of 2,000 because this kind of project really, in a way, seeks to manifest what all those fabulous people themselves believe in. When you hit a sweet spot like that where people do want to do a socially inclusive, well-designed, environmentally radical project, you really get a lot of motivated friends and colleagues stepping forward and doing their best work. It's one of the great joys of a project like this. It's sort of everyone's going, I want to be involved in that. I like that. How can I contribute? And it's just like having this amazing brains trust.
As I was saying in the intro, you've had this fascinating career that's been concerned with, well, the natural world, sustainability. Now you're a developer with a soul, I would posit. The Phoenix, 7.9 hectare brownfield site within the South Downs National Park on the outskirts of Lewes. And you're going to build, as we said in the intro, 685 homes, 30% of which will be affordable. I mean, on your website, it says the project, and I'm going to quote, seeks to turn the imperatives of the climate and natural emergencies into opportunities for better design, better placemaking, and ultimately healthier and better living. You have a background with Greenpeace and you've been this sustainability consultant. I'm intrigued to know how you became involved in this. Is it true that a local pressure group came to you and asked for your help?
The other way around, actually.
Ah, okay.
I suppose the ancient history of it is, at university, I was a human geographer. I was one of those people that gets taken on a field trip to a glacier wearing a kind of sports jacket and a pair of brogues and really wants to be walking the streets of a city working out who lives there and why and what the spatial geography of a place is. So in the 70s, reading Jane Jacobs and David Harvey, Lewis Mumford, Kevin Lynch, you know, all the, I think, you know, still the greats of what makes an urban place thrive and endure.
You've named a square after Jane.
Yes, it's a bit pretentious, isn't it? We might have to revisit that, though she probably wouldn't thank us for it either, but Young Gill might. So academically, I've been interested in this stuff for more than 40 years. And then at the same time, the environmental crisis was something that was spoken about and written about a great deal in the late 70s. And so when you put these issues together, what kind of human settlement, human habitat, is feasible and appropriate in a world with real natural limits, rather than that the biosphere is this giant dustbin, we can just spew anything into that we want and everything will be fine somehow in the end. Those issues came together for me in the late 70s, but I never realized you could get a job or work in it until having done a civil service training, so being trained a bit in management and finance and human resources and all that sort of stuff. I saw an ad for Greenpeace, and I'd been active in the what was then the Ecology Party before the Green Party. It became the Green Party, named after the German Greens. It was originally the Ecology Party. It was a bit of a sort of promising but rather shabby political movement, whereas Greenpeace was this incredibly well-run, well-organized machine with a super brand, you know, well-led, incredible values. And to join that at a key time was an extraordinary experience that gave me a lot of, perhaps too much confidence in a way. You know, once you've worked in a place like that, which is literally changing the world, sadly, we couldn't sustain that, but it felt like the world was shifting on its axis in the mid-80s. And the last project I did there was to create a new headquarters for Greenpeace. And that was my first built environment job. That's when the two parts of my life started coming together.
Which is Field and Clegg Bradley did that.
Yeah, it was. And Patrick Bellew and Neil Thomas.
Yes.
Amazing team, right? Just amazing team. And they were all sort of starting out. Not Field and Clegg had been around a bit. Neil and Patrick were just starting out with their new businesses. And we're still good friends. And just the tangibility of working on a building and using a building to change the culture of an organization somewhat.
Because it had been an animal testing laboratory, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly so. It was in Canterbury. It's still the headquarters now. And it was the first green commercial building in Britain. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, had anyone at Greenpeace ever done a building project before? No. Was there such a thing? Were there any books on what green buildings might be? Any precedents, examples? No. So we had to kind of work it out on first principles. It was really fascinating. And obviously I got the bug and have been working in that space ever since.
Very good. So the Phoenix, though, and human nature, how did that begin? Because there had been proposals for that site before and they hadn't come off. So I guess in the first instance, why hadn't they worked?
There were two sets of proposals before us. And the second set was a remote international investor working through a local project manager and local development company. And they didn't really have an ideology of place or even of development other than that you get planning and you hopefully make some money. And it's, you know, you make it as inoffensive as you can so that it becomes offensive because it's so sort of polite and, you know, in a way banal. But not enough confidence to create the urbanity that would make it economically viable. My wife's family are from Lewis.
Was your wife's father not the mayor of Lewis or something? I mean, this is Lewis kind of aristocracy.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. She's completely blue blood Lewis. Well, grandfather actually was mayor four times. He's a legend in his own lunchtime, particularly for drinking lager, I think, by reputation. I never met him myself. But, you know, our daughter's fourth generation Lewis, so it helps. To a certain extent, living above the shop isn't even in it. You know, or immersed in this place profoundly. Anyway, look, we were here visiting her parents, and we were living in London. And I was a bit bored, and I picked up the local newspaper, and there was a big article about this planning consent for this scheme. And there was a letter from one of the new green councillors complaining about a project, saying that it wasn't of the 21st century, it wasn't sustainable, it didn't pick up on Lewis's qualities. Lewis is a very rambunctious place, you know, it's the home of Thomas Paine and Bonfire Night here, you know, the first English Parliament. It's an incredible history, this place.
Yeah. I mean, the Bonfire Night is an extraordinary thing in Lewis. It is an amazing thing.
Yeah. It's incredible chaos.
Yeah.
And rather wonderfully pagan and kind of beautiful and mad and quite aggressive, you know, it's that.
Yeah.
And then they burn effigies of Rishi Sunak and Donald Trump and all of that, and probably me next year, I imagine. So this councillor was just bemoaning. And there'd been a protest movement called Phoenix Rising, run by incredible people. David Dimbleby organised the public meeting around it. These people did their own master plan, their own viability assessment with Gardner Theobald, and they proved that the previous scheme wasn't going to be viable. They commissioned C.F. Moller to do a master plan, pretty creditable stuff. You know, they were going to make their own planning application in parallel with the owner, which is a weird thing. It was a really well-organised and incredibly theatrical, passionate. It was a bit like a Bonfire Night as a community protest. I wrote to the councillor and said, look, we're moving to Lewis. Is there anything I can do to help you? Being a bit of a campaigner and knowing a bit about real estate and place, maybe I can help. I'm, you know, and knock on the door, and there they were, the committee of this protest group, and they said, these guys are going to sell it. We should come join forces and see what we can do. So we entered a open market process, and it was us, I think, versus Barclay Homes in the end. It was one of Tony Pidgley's last big pitches. And so it was either Barclay Homes in Lewis or Human Nature. And it turned out to be us. We have a bit of our own money, but, you know, I've worked in foundations and campaigning bodies pretty much my entire life. And I don't come from a wealthy background. I'm a working class boy, kind of, from Yorkshire, from the West Riding. And so I don't come at this like a sort of property developer who developed flats in Shepherd's Bush and then did 20 in Knightsbridge and made a few million and then thought I'll do places. I came at it from places being the thing that I love. How do you raise the money to make a new kind of place? And so we put together a group of incredible people, local families in the area who had been part of the protest group, supporting them economically. And everyone just thought, this is the chance to do something wonderful in Lewis for our town. And so we created an investment vehicle and have been fundraising ever since. I spend my life fundraising and putting the zillions together to make a project like this happen.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't a straightforward site, is it, Jonathan? It's on a floodplain for a start. And how does that affect the design?
Every edge on here is challenging. It's a wickedly difficult brownfield project. Lots of different ownerships. It's got an elevated concrete causeway road on one edge, which is a full story height above the level of the rest of the site. It's got an 800-meter river frontage with tidal flooding. It also has flooding runoff from the South Downs, so it's at the low-lying river valley in the Downs. It has a conservation area at the back, and it has the countryside edge to the north. So you've got four incredibly difficult edge conditions, or interesting. You know, difficult equals interesting, I think, in place. And so you can either try and deny it, as it were, and create something that's very unresponsive, or you try and study it and weave in the constraint into an idea of form and structure. And in the end, therefore, a master plan in a place like this starts to form itself. So, for instance, we wanted to retain some of the historic memory. This was an inland port. This was its industrial centre, heart, where everyone worked. It was an ironworks and a paper factory, and it was the throbbing, working that every town used to have. You know, you wouldn't try and retain some of the structures that were here, that were the ironwork structures made from, you guessed it, iron, and they're pretty robust, resilient structures, very adaptable. So in deciding which structures we could keep that would stand the test of time, trying to keep the two main roads, which had defined the connectivity, and then responding to the edge conditions, and then dealing with key views, which is a critical factor in a landscape visual impact assessment, sorry to be all technical. And then when you've decided what your residential block typologies are, which we do from precedent studies. So we have an in-house design team, architects, that when we start a project, we produce a, what we call a blueprint as part of the brief, and we give them 20 themes. So things like, we've got one called open house, which is the idea that there should be a place next to a house where you can invite your neighbours to come and have a meal to create that sort of social conviviality in a place. We've got a principle called inside out, where you design an apartment from the inside as well as the outside. It's not just what the architecture is like as a public spectacle, but how does it inform the way that we might want to live more sustainably? What does that mean? We've got one called abundant green, which is, if you're going to be more urban, how can you introduce additional greenery to soften the urbanity, create that colour and texture? So what the team then does is they go and find, or we say, you know, we love courtyard blocks for the following reasons. Therefore, can we find the 8 best recent courtyard or older courtyard blocks in Europe? And so they go off and find these wonderful examples from Swiss and Dutch and Herzog de Meuron and Jan Gehl's favourite urban block in Copenhagen. And then we unpack those and look at what works and why. And then we put a bit of Lewis into it. And then we say we're going to build in timber because we believe that embodied carbon is a massive burden that we can't afford to place on the global climate. And that defines you a bit of a master plan.
Can I ask about that? I mean, if your aim is to create a sustainable development, I mean, is it possible to look beyond CLT currently?
Not easily, I would say, actually, frankly. I don't know that there's much else that you could do if you're building urbanity. I think that you can use timber panels and other bio-based materials, but we're at 5 stories here, so 18 meters, and CLT, LVL, glulam, but primarily CLT is a critical part of that with panels. But if you're building 3 stories, you could do happily work with panels. Wonderfully simple, as you well know, I'm sure, but intermediate technology, it's very kind of reassuringly simple and straightforward. You can even use Sussex timber for panels, which we love.
Yeah, I was going to ask where your timber comes from in the main, because presumably it isn't the UK right now.
We don't have the scale of and quality of forestry or slow growth timber that's suitable for CLT at the quantities that we need it. Neither do we have the industry. And so to create an industry, which in turn would help create the forests, but the forests by definition take a long time to grow. So at the moment, if you're using CLT, you're in Austria, Switzerland, Slovenia, Scandinavia. And happily, those countries have invested in their engineering industrial base. And so they have wonderful, extraordinary factories for CLT manufacture. It's like going into a Tesla factory. You know, we went on a tour of Sussex sawmills, and it's like, you know, you've got a child with an eye patch and one hand walking around in a sort of Dickensian, you know, with a big metal saw going around sawing, and you know, in an Austrian CLT factory, there's a BIM plan that arrives digitally to a robot that cuts it perfectly, no waste. And it gets shipped over here and you can assemble a 5-story building in 17 weeks. It's just fantastic.
Mm. And there's a lot of hemp being used.
Hempcrete.
Hempcrete, indeed.
Again, you know, material cultures were people that inspired us in that regard. And then we looked into it and we found a wonderful company called Greencore. And they have got a factory that produces hempcrete timber panels in Bicester that we love. And so getting the license to grow hemp, because again, it's a wonderfully regenerative crop.
Yeah, you have to go to the Home Office.
You have to go to the Home Office and make it clear that you're not planning to smoke it, remembering that it's not actually the same plant. But, you know, it's a wonderful soil restorer. It's great for ecology, quick to grow, easy to work with, resilient, fire resistant, unbelievable product. The Romans used it. And again, you know, watching this stuff being made is a wonderful experience because, you know, you're literally looking at someone with a galvanized steel tub, a sack of hemp chips and the tap, and you pour the chips into the tub and turn the tap on and stir it, and then you leave it to dry. I'm slightly oversimplifying, but that's essentially how you build how you make a building, with a timber panel with some lovely German cutting machinery, but with Sussex timber. That is part of a wonderful chain of regeneration that can happen with a project like this.
It's a wonderful material, hemp. I mean, it can be used from anything from bread to buildings. It's amazing stuff. There's a lovely turn of phrase on your website that says you'll be mining the Anthropocene. What does that mean?
Well, actually, it's Duncan Baker Brown, if you know Duncan. You know, famous for the Waste House and for climate change work with RIBA and everyone else. And Duncan is a Lewisian and a friend. And we invited him into the master planning team at the beginning. We talked about his expertise in identifying materials that could be salvaged. His argument, which is summed up by that phrase, the Anthropocene being effectively the man-made Earth. You know, some geologists talk about that we're in the Anthropocene era now, that impacts of human beings on the biosphere is geological, effectively. So he's saying that in this Anthropocene era, particularly on a former industrial site, you've got all these materials already, well, a lot of materials already here. So how are we going to mine those materials and repurpose them on this site? Lewis is this incredible community, by the way. So we've got local work studio nearby who specialize in exactly that, auditing sites, identifying what you've got, how you can create new aggregates, reuse existing structures and materials. So there are audits being done, and we're planning the Thomas Paine Bridge, which will be made from salvaged steels. Thomas Paine was a bridge designer as well as an author of The American Revolution.
I did not know that. Well, there you go. The other thing that I found intriguing is that they're going to be places for residents to set up their own ventures, and you're going to be encouraging them to be upcycling, repairing and reusing.
This is a mixed-use neighbourhood. It's a proper urban neighbourhood. It's not just residential. It's got all sorts of other uses. But one in particular is, again, thinking about what Lewis's strengths and interests are. We're hoping not to generalise too much, but there's a lot of people who make things here in this community. Building materials, wonderful carpenters, a lot of skilled carpenters, jewellery makers. There's also a younger generation coming through, computer programmers, musicians, digital designers. And so a circular economy is key, I believe, to the productivity of the British economy, which we're not a very productive economy. The Swedes, for instance, are 25% more productive. They produce more in 4 days than we do in five. So, you know, everyone in politics agrees that productivity is a key challenge to address. So if we become more productive at producing stuff that destroys the biosphere, that's a bad thing.
Yes.
But what if we become really productive and really creative in a circular economy by providing services rather than goods, dematerializing things, sharing tools, sharing services, using a car club rather than everybody owning a private car that stands on the drive 95% of the time? That's just intrinsic inefficiency. If you can meet the utility of using a car for certain key journeys in a different way without everyone having to own one, then you can save as much as £3,000 a year for every household. Imagine also the embodied carbon savings, fewer vehicles, and then the efficiency of their use. It equals a productive economy and a circular economy, as an example.
Yeah, I mean, the transport hub is interesting. So there won't be, I don't know, loads of white vans with Amazon deliveries going to people's doors. Presumably, you won't be encouraging large supermarket ordered deliveries either.
They'll all come to a central point. So, you know, this is only a neighbourhood. It's not our town or anything. It's in no way do we have any right or opportunity, and neither are we invited to try to change the town. But what we can do is say, if you live here, then made big deliveries of any kind will be taken to a central place right by the main road. And then you either collect them on your way home or they're delivered to you by cycle courier. And again, that's just a really efficient way of doing it. So it's something like 1 in 8 vehicles in a town like this are deliveries these days.
Yeah.
Frankly. So again, it's just an intrinsic inefficiency. And if you want streets to be really civilized again, where human beings are prioritized rather than cars, not anti-car, it's just saying, let's get our priorities right. I grew up in a street in suburban Leeds playing football and cricket in the middle of the street with all the kids from the neighborhood. And, you know, you can't do that here, but you'd be able to do that at the Phoenix. And, you know, occasionally you'll have to move your wicket because a repair vehicle will come through. But you,
the idea of kids playing cricket full stop is a wonderful thing. You have to encourage them to play before they have to move their stumps, I think. But anyway, that's the by the by.
Fair enough. Maybe it will be the renaissance of cricket among young people.
You're not only going to save the planet, you're going to bring cricket back. I think that's a wonderful thing. Who needs the 100? There are 18 housing blocks designed by 12 different architects. Ash Sakula is doing the first parcel. There's going to be May and Charles Holland, Mole, Adam Richards, our friends at Material Cultures, and Summer Islam has been a guest on the podcast. How did you go about choosing them, Jonathan?
Well, you know, I've been working with architects for 40 years now, and I've been interested in architecture forever. And so I read the magazines and go to events. And I was so lucky to start working experience in architecture with Peter Clegg and Richard Fielden. And so they introduce you to good people like Patrick and Neil, and they introduce good people. I worked with Future Systems and Will Alsop and Bill Dunster in the early days. I had a lovely note from Amanda Levett the other day, just saying hi. We haven't seen Amanda for maybe 24 years or something. So that combination of good people introducing good people. I've worked on lots of other projects as a consultant for 15 years, projects at various scales. And then, you know, picking a few obvious people early on who then said, oh, have you met Al Jawad Pike? They're doing a wonderful scheme over in Orr. And then, you know, I saw the hemp house that Material Cultures did.
Yes.
And loved it.
Steve Barron, who's been on the podcast actually as well.
And I love the aesthetic of it. I love that sense of the materials being quite raw. So approached Paloma and Summer and George. And Meredith I've known forever. I've done work with him before. Alex Elliott, I always work with Alex. I found him about the most civilized human being, let alone architect. Delight meeting Adam Richards. So he lives in the South Downs over in Petworth. Lovely house that he designed himself. And he did the Ditchling Museum rather beautifully.
Mm.
So he felt like a natural choice. Charles Holland approached me and did an incredible study of Lewis. And literally kind of like a magpie taking elements and putting them back together. We haven't used that work fully yet, but Charles will be involved going forward. So it's a bit like that, you know, it's kind of, you accumulate through recommendations. Then you think, I've got this particular condition in this part of the site at this edge. What sort of feel should it have? And that suggests a particular architect. So in the process, we asked architects to do studies of different bits. Some weren't very convincing, some were wholly convincing. We fully intend to follow through and capture that quality and diversity, because in a way that's a defining quality of Lewis. It has this extraordinary architectural plot definition and diversity. That is a defining Lewisian condition.
Mm. It's interesting because they are all really talented architects. With a number of them, and this excludes Material Cultures, obviously, I hadn't necessarily associated them with building in timber before. That wasn't a prerequisite in your thinking.
Well, actually, Mole have built a lot in timber. Alex Ely, Sterling Prize, timber building. Adam is doing a health centre in timber. I think they all have one way or another. And I think that we were more drawn to their aesthetic sensibility and their values as people and designers, knowing that because of those qualities that in our process together, and because we work with a timber contractor and a really good timber engineer, they're part of the team from the early stages, is there's a lot of practical help for the architects, because we don't want statement architecture that we can't build. We want buildings that have good architecture, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, another phrase that I enjoyed was your building principle, which you describe as raw and craft. What does that entail?
It's two things, really. It acknowledges that building in CLT is essentially an industrial process. It's natural materials, but it's robots, it's a factory. They're kits of parts and they're assembled through, as it were, a modern logistical approach. And therefore, how do you leaven that? Where's the hand in that? If you get economies from that process and it enables you to use natural materials, how do you render that economy in a way that makes it more humane rather than an industrial product? And given Lewis's myriad makers and carpenters in the town, how can we create special elements within that to create more human environments? Felt important. So Roar and Craft came from that. And secondly, it's effectively a zero-base budgeting exercise. So you say, how much does it cost to build a good building, a resilient Stuart brand adaptable envelope? It's got to have good foundations and a good adaptable, strong structure, needs a roof, got to meet fire regs and, you know, all of that. How do you do that? And then until you've done that, you haven't got a budget. So what does that cost? Because we know we're going to build in timber. And then how much have you got left for everything else? And what choice can you offer the customer as to where you should spend that money? So we can decide as a developer, but, you know, given that in every other significant product, let alone the thing that is going to be your biggest ever investment in life, you get some customer choice as to, I don't know, and I just the example of a car, almost everything these days. So why don't we say we've got X amount of money left within our cost envelope? Do you want a particular kind of window for that view? It might just be one window like that. The others might need to be super standard. But if that's what you'd like and you're early enough in the process of buying to influence the design, which is what we intend, that we promote these things very quickly, right, then that's what you can have. And then the fit out, similarly, a craft-based fit out. If you just want a kitchen that has a cooker, a fridge, and your granny's table and a couple of old chairs, you went to the Enzo Mari exhibition at the Design Museum.
I was there last week. Yeah, absolutely.
Get a few nails and a few planks.
Build it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And then otherwise you've got a little molded plastic IKEA chair from 1984, now an antique and worth a fortune probably. But you're going to save yourself £7,000 on the developer's kitchen fit out, even if you use IKEA, the cheapest kitchens you could buy. Do you know what I mean? And so you've got customer choice, you've got Roar and Craft, you've got a different aesthetic. It's a really disciplined way of thinking about a building budget, we reckon.
Mm. And you're starting an apprenticeship scheme to train local people in building these materials.
So two biggest challenges probably after the economics of this project, having got through planning: labor supply, skilled labor, because young people don't want to go into construction for various reasons. And secondly, the manufacture of timber panels, which is essentially a factory-based exercise. And so given that we think, certainly on our projects, because we're looking at lots of other schemes to build a portfolio, quite apart from, you know, what needs to happen in terms of embodied carbon. So if Keir Starmer really does intend and does build 300,000 homes a year, which is what he says he will, and he builds them all in a conventional way, there goes your carbon budget forever.
Yes. Nobody in politics ever talks about that, do they?
Completely.
I mean, people talk about flights, but nobody talks about the carbon of construction in mainstream politics, at least.
It's a massive blind spot, and the people in the industry don't either because they don't know how to deal with it. So we believe that the foreseeable future is bio-based materials, including stone, by the way. Even Jeremy Clarkson agrees with me on that, although he's very anti-timber. Obviously the god of the built environment, but...
Yes, I was going to ask about the importance of Clarkson's opinion in that particular sphere, but
none,
anyway.
But it was just amusing saying, well, maybe it wasn't very amusing.
No, it's making me laugh.
If the future is bio-based materials, we better create an industry that knows how to do it. Mm. And I actually think that we need a green construction industrial strategy going forward. But in the absence of one, we need a mini one here. And so if you're in economic development in East Sussex, the idea of regenerating woodland by creating a demand for local timber, of building a specialized green construction industry populated by young people who now see it as something desirable rather than something they run a mile from, i.e. to get involved in construction, where you can do everything from be trained as an engineer to help build the CLT structures or craft finishers or both or somewhere in between, and have that sort of literally pride in place, just feels like a fantastic project in its own right. And so you can say, oh, human nature, you promise all these things. But I don't know that there's any other way. I don't know we've got any choice about these things. If climate catastrophe and nature catastrophe actually mean something rather than are just rhetorical flourishes that we like writing at the front of policies, so beautiful they make you cry, and then ignore them. If they mean anything, then developers and local authorities in partnerships, we have to do this stuff. It's not a choice. It's not like, oh, that's mad, you know, that's too difficult. It's not a question of whether it will work, it's how we make it work. And I think people like that. I think they like you putting a flag. A lot of people like to mock it. It's like, oh yeah, there they go again. And I'm like, well, it's the only way we're going to change the world.
I hope you're enjoying the show. This is just to let you know that the Material Matters Fair returns to Barge House, Oxo Tower Wharf this September from the 18th to 21st. We've signed up an array of fascinating exhibitors already, including Biotech's Future, a project on future fibres led by Adidas and RWTH Aachen University. Hydro will be there with its Circal 100R aluminium pieces made entirely from recycled post-consumer scrap. And AHEC will be showing its latest experiments with American maple. We're also working with leading architect T.P. Bennett and the Furniture Practice on a special project that looks at the material stories of our leading furniture manufacturers. But there are still some spaces remaining. Keen to exhibit? Do drop me a line at hello@materialmatters.design. That's hello@materialmatters.design. Also, if your brand is looking to reach the design world, there are a plethora of sponsorship opportunities. My partner William Knight and I would be delighted to hear from you. Can we talk about placemaking? I mean, is this something we've forgotten how to do in this country, in your view?
Yeah. Yeah. In this office, I've got a library of maybe 300 books on design, urban design, place, architecture, history of cities, and so on. And I don't know that many people have ever read them or thought about these things carefully. It's almost like we use the word placemaking, a horrible phrase as well, in a way. It's like it's become like sustainability or good design. They're just words now. And actually, it's really important that we define what we mean. And that if someone like Kevin Lynch has taken the trouble to do an amazing piece of research and write it up for you and publish a famous book on how to make a city incredibly rich as a human experience, feels to me that you have an obligation, if you're doing a big development, to look at that work and the work of others, weigh it up and think, what can I learn from that that I can apply in a development? But actually, development is driven by simple construction systems, simplified risk-averse Excel spreadsheets, and short-term investment returns. And I've seen it happen at close quarters as a consultant on big projects all over Britain. And actually, place is this layered, sensuous, complex thing, but we've known about it for millennia. An old friend of mine, Paul Moraine, talks about how towns are. It's just, you know, every historic city and town had certain clear principles of urban design that were almost the same wherever you are in the world. And whether it's Beijing, Mesopotamia, central Cairo, a Tuscan hill town, Lewis, an urban village, these clear principles. And some nice people like Lynch and Jan Giel and Jane Jacobs and Lewis Mumford have written about these things for us ad nauseum. And so why we can't be bothered to read this stuff and train ourselves as a planning profession and as a design profession, I don't know.
Mm. I mean, when I was doing the research for all this, my mind at times went back to Prince Charles, or King Charles rather now, and Poundbury, which is described as a urban extension on the outskirts of Dorchester in Dorset. I remember going to a lecture by Leon Creer, and much of what he said about its design made complete sense as far as I could work out. When I visited, it wasn't my aesthetic, but I could see why people might enjoy living there. The major issue with it was that it turned its back on the rest of the town. There was an estate next door, which it seemed to want to ignore. Now, obviously, the aesthetic of the Phoenix will be very different, but I wonder how you stop that happening at the Phoenix, that the Phoenix becomes its own micro-community that doesn't deal with the rest of Lewis.
Poundbury, for me, is a remarkable project in so many ways. I agree with you. I think a lot of the principles are well articulated and made manifest. And I think it's a very sophisticated and successful urban design. I think it has huge flaws, like, you know, Queen Mother Square is a massive car park. It's got slightly ridiculous architecture in its pompous central buildings. But, and it's also, it's the King of England on land that he owns building a place. And so therefore it's automatically kind of weird. I think it's a sort of form of paternalism, and it's a bit of, yeah, paternalism that I just personally find really, really difficult, whether or not one likes the aesthetic. And I don't much, but I get that a lot of people do. And I'm completely personally at peace with that. Here, we live in Lewes. We are Lewes. Our team mostly lives in Lewes. Our investors are from Lewes. So you can't tell me it's not Lewisian. You know, I spent the whole of COVID, I walked around this town for 10 weeks every day, looking at every condition and corner and street and type. And our architects all did that incredibly respectfully. And what we picked up was not, what does Lewes look like? It's more, what's the essence of Lewes? What's its spirit? You know, the Georgians wasn't some sort of strange, ephemeral aesthetic. It was based on a profound idea about their movement, about their world as it was. And of course, very bourgeois stuff. Fine Georgian architecture wasn't available to the ordinary, everyday Lewisian, as it were. But, you know, a place like Lewes has Victorian, Edwardian, 50s. It's got loads of mistakes, lots of crap buildings that somehow in juxtaposition with something a bit finer. Gilbert Scott built a library here. It looks weird. The brewery, you know, you would never have got through a modern design panel, but people love it. And so I think what we were trying to do here was to get plot definition within blocks, get something that was radical in the spirit of a radical town and community that was addressing climate catastrophe. This is a green town. It votes green. Mm. So anything that wasn't is a departure. But meanwhile, you know, create time-honored structures of place that just work. You know they work because you can see them in all, you know, places people go on holiday and go, I loved that place. And you go, well, why did you love it? And they describe it. And they can never, we do this when we do public consultation, where's the best place you've ever been and why? And they describe it. And we say, well, why can't you have that here? And they never make the connection. They go, no, modern development does this. And we go, well, why, you know, why?
Mm. With the car share, we talked about the bike service, et cetera, who pays and runs for those, Jonathan?
Well, the users. So if you're saving, we have a principle called radical affordability, which addresses cost of living, not just affordable housing. Now, you know, most of this project is going to be very expensive because of it's brownfield and it's Lewes. There's no way of doing it, given that we had to buy the land and put 60 million into infrastructure and flood defences. But 30% of it is affordable. But how do you make it genuinely affordable to live here while offering high quality services? So, you know, there'll be an estate management charge, but it's got to be affordable again. And people have to see what the money goes on and see its benefits. You've got to manage the flood defences, the courtyard gardens, the streets. The county council won't adopt the roads because they've got modern suds features, which were obliged to put in by planning, but the county is not obliged to manage them. We are. But when you use a vehicle in the car club, you pay for using it. It's just that because it's well organized as a business, there's a sort of mass bulk purchasing thing that goes on that means it's much more affordable than if you tried to do it yourself. And compared to owning a car, which is static for 95%, it's a huge economy. No, there are some car parking spaces. There will be people with white vans who are plumbers. They should have priority for the parking here because they need a vehicle for their work. Now, you know, we can't change the public transport system or the spatial geography of Lewes and its district. I wish, but no one's asked us. It's not our job. So we have to work within the real world as we find it today. But, you know, by and large, you won't move here if you feel the need to own a car and park it in your drive in front of your house.
Mm. I mean, is there some long-term guarantee that, I don't know, prices don't get hiked, services don't go up or disappear? And there's a wonderful play on at the West End at the moment called Standing at the Sky's Edge, songs by Richard Hawley, that illustrates a kind of, I guess, a different type of utopian development that aimed to take people out of the slums after the war, Park Hill in Sheffield, and went wrong. I'm wondering how you keep these, I mean, really glorious initial ideas intact in the long term.
Well, firstly, I think it's important that we don't frame them as utopian ideas. It's easy to do so. But when you think that what I'm arguing, and I believe it to be true, is that we're designing a place that is time-honored in its form and structure. There's nothing weird about it. It's very easy to understand where that comes from. The second thing is that we intend to stay in all the way through. We're raising a lot of money at the moment. It's about $200 million for the first funding package. And it's important that we connect investors that are enthusiastic to be on this journey with us rather than pushing against it. And so far, so good. The major institutional investors have ESG policies which align very squarely with what we do, but are often not used in practice. So this attracts people who really want to do this kind of thing. There isn't really an investment class that makes places in this country, and that's something that needs to change. That will happen. But there are enough good investors out there, I think, to be able to do the job with us here. And then we have to solve problems as we go through good people and working closely with the community and the local authority, South Downs National Park, Lewis District Council, to sustain it and make it work. There's no guarantees. There's no promise. I'm not sitting here saying it's a walk in the park. It's going to be bloody difficult. But we have a lot of good people and a lot of experience, and we intend to see it through. You know, we come from this philosophy and from these values. It's the entire purpose of our business. It's not something we've tacked on as a way of making money. And I think people are really disarmed by that. You know, when it was first announced that we were buying the site, a lot of people were like, oh, greenwashing. These people, they're just like everyone else. They're just the developers. And actually, on this occasion, it's just not true.
Can we talk about your background? You have alluded to it a little, but I would suggest it's fairly unique for a developer. You were brought out just outside Leeds in a mining village. What did your parents do?
My mum worked in a shop, and my dad was a packaging engineer. And their parents were both in council housing. The grandpas were miners, and the grandmas were housewives.
Okay. So no kind of activism wasn't kind of in your bones or your DNA in that sense?
Actually, a tiny bit, in that one of our grandfathers was active in the National Union of Mine Workers and used to run the kind of community club and football club. We all adored him. He was like the community man who like made things happen for people. And I think that really rubbed off. I think our parents were that generation where you'd never had it so good. It was the advent of the washing machine and the television. And so they sort of rather were embarrassed by their backgrounds. And I don't want to romanticize the backgrounds. They were tough upbringings. It was pretty obvious to us as kids growing up that the world that they were making, as it were, or clinging onto the coattails of, wasn't going to be it. End happily. That kind of new materialism, as it were, was not a way of finding joy or fulfillment. And so one was always conscious that there was something else out there. We were in a mining area in the middle of rhubarb fields and open cast coal mines. We used to play in the quarries and jump in the big metal buckets that go across the coal fields. It was very dangerous and really hilarious. And, you know, we knew that there was another world out there. We just not experienced it. I remember going to Paris when I was 11 on a school field trip. And I was like, oh, my God. look at what people can do. I was like, I'm home. You know, this is it.
That's interesting. I mean, I was thinking about this morning. It seems to me you're of that age, which means you were probably in the sweet spot for the punk explosion in 1976. Was that an influence on you?
That was huge. I mean, every Thursday we would run down to get our copy of the NME and read about the latest Sex Pistols scandal. And we used to go to Cleethorpes Winter Gardens to watch whatever punk band, The Damned, were there. I think Ian Dury came there, The Clash. It was an incredible period. And it was that sort of, because I was never a hippie. I never really understood all that stuff. None of my family were. It was a middle class thing, really, the hippie thing. Punk seemed political. I'm not sure it was, but as a gesture, it was political. It was like rejection.
Well, Joe Strummer was. I'm not sure some of the others were, but yeah.
Yeah. And I just loved the whole Julie Birchall, Tony Parsons, gunslinger writing thing. It just felt like I didn't really understand it. It was just like a creative rejection of something and an expression of difference and newness, which I found very appealing. So, yeah.
Mm. So you went to Newcastle, studied geography, kind of discovered ecology or an interest in ecology began, became a civil servant working in the NHS, and subsequently you made what looks on paper to be this enormous leap to become director of Greenpeace UK. And I'm kind of intrigued how that happened.
As I said, intellectually, it was this reading into the environmental crisis. And at the same time, thinking about underdeveloped countries, as they used to be called, in certainly the geography courses I was doing, so in Latin America and Africa in particular, which were modules at university for me, I was thinking about how can these countries develop if the development model leads to the destruction of the biosphere? Clearly, that's a problem. So what's the alternative model of development? So you then read Schumacher and Ivan Illich, and you look at things like de-schooling society and challenges to industrialization in search of a different model, a different economic model, a different cultural model, a different way of thinking about the world we're in. Get very confused because it's, you know, it's a bit much for a 19-year-old. You can't quite, you don't know anything, but you're reading all this stuff and your head's spinning. And I left university, I thought, I don't know shit. I can barely write a letter, let alone do anything. I've got all these ideas in my head. I better go and learn how to be practical. So I did a fast stream civil service thing, and that equipped me to, I don't know, do certain things. And it just felt when Greenpeace wanted a managing director to help it get a bit better organized and look after its money and its brand and its do a strategy and planning and thinking and look after the people, actually, together with my interests in the issues. But I was a bit snotty about Greenpeace. I'm like, you're an environmentalist organization. I'm not an environmentalist. And that was a bit of a discordant thing, really, for me. But I just loved its agency, right? It was incredible, or is an incredible organization.
And did you just answer an advert?
I did, yeah. This was 86, so just after the Rainbow Warrior had been sunk.
Yeah, I was going to say the Rainbow Warrior was 85, wasn't it, where the French intelligence services sunk the boat when it was going to protest against the nuclear testing near New Zealand.
That's right.
What was the state of the organisation when you arrived?
Well, it was 12 people, and it was in the corner of a wood warehouse in Islington. And the previous directors had just been fired by Greenpeace International for starting their own campaigns that had not been ratified by the International Federation of Greenpeace Bodies around the world. They started, rather famously, the Lynx Fur campaign. That wasn't a Greenpeace-sanctioned campaign, and also the organisation was in a bit of a mess, frankly. So they brought in this rather incredible guy, my mentor and great hero, Lord Peter Melcher, such a hilarious name, but hereditary peer. His father was, they're a sort of grand family, you know. His grandfather was one of the founders of ICI. His father was chairman of British Steel. You know, he went to Eton and Cambridge, and there he is aged 30 as chairman of Greenpeace UK, because he was a very active environmentalist. He'd been a junior minister in the Callaghan government, aged 26. So I walked into this wood warehouse, and there was Peter sitting in the corner. And it's an extraordinary Canadian campaigner who used to be the guy that would put himself, his body, over a seal cub in northern Canada with someone about to club the seal. And this guy would, like, sort of do the human sacrifice, non-violent direct action. And he was the new executive director. And they wanted someone to come and help get it organized. And so I had this privilege of working with these guys. It was a shambles, but a wonderful creative shambles. And the skill was not to lose that while getting it better organized.
So is that what you were bought in to do, to organize them better, essentially?
Yeah.
Interesting. So why did you leave? You left in 1990.
Well, because I'm not an environmentalist.
Fair enough.
So, you know, the day that the Gro Harlem Brundtland launched the World Commission on Environment and Development, which introduced sustainable development as a compelling new concept for the world, we did an action on Gro Harlem Brundtland because she was the Prime Minister of Norway, which is a whaling nation. And I was a bit, hang on a minute, there are bigger issues here. I'm not pro-whaling, I'm very anti it, but here's a moment in the world where, which is incredibly significant. And I thought it was really cheap. And I realized I believed more in sustainability than I do in environmentalism. It gave me a kind of a worldview that it put together things for me that were hitherto quite disparate.
And then there was a kind of interregnum. Your wife, who's an artist, Joanna, got a big project, and you looked after your eldest child who'd just been born. And is that when the idea for the Earth Centre, well, presumably it must have been the idea at the time when the Earth Centre was germinated.
Actually, yeah, just a quick correction to, well, so it was my previous wife, actually, who very sadly died last week.
Ah, sorry.
She was an artist, and yeah, she did. She won a commission to build a sculpture of Jackie Milburn, the famous Geordie footballer. in a bronze and we needed a big barn, and we were living in East London at that time in a flat, and it wasn't easy to build a 12-foot sculpture of a footballer. So we moved to a little, a common, a wood in a common near Petworth, actually next to where Adam Richards built his new house, really weirdly, right. Coincidentally. And our next door neighbour was chairman of the European Museum of the Year Award. He was a publisher and quite a well-known expert on museums. And he and I would chat over dinner, because neighbours, and we knew their son very well. This was 1989, 1990. And he was like, why isn't there a museum? Given that every time you turn the TV on, there's a program about the state of the world's environment, the new Attenborough series. It was a time when the Berlin Wall was coming down. So you had perestroika, but you also had this massive media coverage of global environmental issues. He said, how come there isn't a modern natural history museum or modern science museum? And I was like, do you know what? I think there isn't, is there? He's really right. So I did a load of research. And I read a wonderful book by a guy called Kenneth Hudson called Museums of the Future, I think. And there was a wonderful phrase in there, and it was, the great museums are inspired by the greatest yearnings, frustrations, perplexities, and opportunities of humankind. So I was like, what are the greatest perplexities, yearnings, frustrations of the modern era? Sustainability. So I wrote a concept paper, which was, if we were to be building the Prince Albert Museums today, their theme would be the science and industry of sustainability, the art of sustainability, and the ecology of sustainability. So why don't we build one?
I mean, maybe for people who are too young to remember, the centre was essentially one of the Millennium Projects. It opened in 1999, just outside Doncaster, on a site that had been a coal mine in Collinsborough. It featured work, as we mentioned, from an array of architecture and design talents, Will Alsop, Bill Dunster, Future Systems, as we said. So, I mean, maybe for listeners who don't remember it or were too young, what was the thinking behind it? I mean, obviously, it was about sustainability, but how did you tackle that subject?
Well, I wish I hadn't tried. It's an incredibly, it's almost an impossible subject to cover in that way. So Tim Smith had the better idea, which was to just create a museum about plants and use plants as a metaphor for these issues. That was a more elegant way. But for me, it didn't really cover proper sustainability, which is it's a worldview, and it does address those different ideas. And sometimes you need to see it through art, because as Paul Klee said, you know, great art catches what he called the forces and processes of nature. It's not representative, you're capturing its essence, just as at the Phoenix, we're trying to capture the essence of Lewis and of a community. We're not trying to make it look like something. Similarly, you know, you need the science, you need the industry, because that's what's going to help us solve these problems, you know, is new energy technologies and transport technologies and battery technologies and lighting technologies. We need to build in a different way. So we needed to create buildings that were different kinds of exemplars of those ideas. And then we needed to regenerate our damaged industrial land in a really hopeful way, using ecological techniques and methods to celebrate how we could heal the wounds of the Industrial Revolution while regenerating the communities that both made that Industrial Revolution happen for everyone's benefit, but also created some of these global environmental problems that we faced with, only for those same communities to be completely abandoned in the Thatcher era and left to their own devices. So it was very poetic, but also just too difficult. So we'd been not offered, but we were taken on a tour of Bankside Power Station,
which obviously now Tate Modern.
And they said, would you like this for your Earth Centre? And I was like, I love it, but we shouldn't be in London. This was the iconoclast in me, ridiculous decision. We needed to be in a real place, and we needed to be part of a regeneration story. It was just a bit too hard doing that in Doncaster, frankly. I'm sorry, but it just was.
Yeah, too complex and in a place that wasn't quite ready for it. Is that why it failed, do you think, in retrospect?
It was potentially a global institution. You know, Coopers and Lybrand were commissioned to do the business plan for it, a big commission. And they said that this has the potential to become a new national institution for sustainability. Britain needs it. We got lots of buy-in, including from the Millennium Commission, for that idea. But doing that in a coalfield community in South Yorkshire was just in the too hard box. Every time there was a public fund, it was needed more for, you know, everyday regeneration projects for people rather than this shining star, as it were. So assembling the funding to do that was really difficult. Whereas in London, you know, if you're at Tate Modern, you just look across the river and you've got the City of London. So you just think about who your trustees are, you know, and where the money comes from. You've got Westminster, you can invite the Chancellor to come to your opening, and you try and get them to come to Doncaster. But look, it was an amazing project. And I think, you know, when you go there now, it's this beautiful 200-acre New English forest. We planted over 120,000 trees. Some of the buildings were incredible, pioneering projects. Patrick Bellew still talks about the energy systems that he put in. We had the biggest flat array of PV panels in Europe at the time. A load of R&D was done on ecological remediation. We had Britain's first at-scale ecological sewage treatment works. It was a remarkable thing, and a lot of designers and engineers cut their teeth trying to work out what a sustainable building was. And I think one of the things it did for me was that it taught me a lesson when you're working with high road architects, as Stuart Brand might call them, about how to do that on a budget, which is what real places are like, actually. A lot of the learning for the Phoenix has come from some of the innovative work that we were doing back then. But, you know, it's 30 years ago. So trying to do a radical sustainability project 33 years ago on a coal mine in South Yorkshire.
Now, is actually remarkable when you think about it. I mean, it's extraordinary. And what struck me when I was researching you and this was I was wondering whether you might sweep it under the kind of the carpet of your CV. But I think rightly so, you seem actually quite fiercely proud of it, actually.
It got a kicking in the right-wing press right from the very beginning, because you know, sustainability is a very political concept. It's challenging, right? It challenges power structures and ideologies. And also being in Doncaster in South Yorkshire, it's not, you know, it's left wing, it's NUM, it's part of Thatcher beat them. And so having it there was like a thing. So the right wing press, and then one of my trustees at the launch, when we'd been offered, it was the biggest Millennium Grant after the Dome, and it was the second to be announced.
Yeah, 21 million, I think, wasn't it?
50. We were offered.
50 million.
Offered.
Right.
So, but you had to match it pound for pound before you could draw it down. So you didn't put 50 million in your bank. So you try and do that on a coal mine in South Yorkshire compared to Bankside Power Station. You know what I mean? It was just unfair rules, frankly. But yeah, look, it was the forerunner to things that we now take for granted as things that we have to do. And it was 30 years ago, and a lot of incredible people worked on it. And we had a wonderful reception in the local community at the time. And I'm proud of that place when I go back there now, and I'm proud of its legacy. I just wish it tried too hard to become like a leisure visitor attraction, when really it should have been much more about learning and training and innovation. And that's what we always wanted it to be, but the Millennium Masters.
Well, it was all infotainment, wasn't it? I mean, the Dome was classically so, and trying to match brands with public money. And yeah, it was an interesting time. Jonathan, our time is nearly up. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Final question. Plans for the future, both for the Phoenix and for you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it too, Grant. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. A really enjoyable conversation. I think plans for the Phoenix, well, build it, make loads of mistakes, do as many things well as we can, watch it evolve, create a community, not just a built place, keep looking at the North Star with it and don't compromise too much. Build a portfolio of projects. So we've got projects at five different scales in our portfolio now. So we're looking at new community, rural extension and urban extension and urban infill. And I'm just talking to some London boroughs and Manchester and Bristol about doing some refurb and, you know, whole neighbourhood regeneration in an existing place, using the ideas and methodologies and values here. It's a really popular thing. And, you know, because it's about impact, it's about switching a model that's been one of the most destructive forces in society, which is construction sector and the way we make places and how the behaviours that that inculcates is an important political act. And you know, we've got to change that structure and that system. And the built environment's got to mean something again, other than just short-term profit for investors.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, really good luck with the rest of it. I mean, it seems to me it is the future, or it has to be the future. So I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time, Grant.
To find out more about the Phoenix, go to phoenixlewis.com. As ever, to find the other podcasts that I've done and to sign up to our newsletter, go to materialmatters.design. And there are images relating to the interviews on our Instagram page, which is also materialmatters.design. Finally, this is really important too. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us from. And it would make me incredibly happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. For as little as £2.50 a month, you can receive an invite to various Material Matters events, as well as getting access to each episode before it's published to the wider world. Material Matters is a completely independent concern, and any help you can offer would be hugely appreciated. Ultimately, you'll be helping to take the message to the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks very much for listening.